immigrants. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio echoed mayors across the country in saying he would not allow police officers to be used as immigration enforcement agents. This is what he said.
We will not deport law-abiding New Yorkers. We will not tear families apart. We will not leave children without their parents. We will not take breadwinners away from families who have no one else. And we're not going to undermine the hard-won trust that has developed between our police and our communities. This executive order is very vague. And our corporation counsel, Zach Carter, is here, former U.S. attorney earlier in his life, and made very clear to me today that if any action is taken as a result to restrict our funding, at that point we will bring legal action to stop it.
So that's New York Mayor Bill de Blasio. Eric Andiola, we just have 5 seconds, but sanctuary cities and states like California.
Absolutely. This is the time for the sanctuary cities all over the country and other cities to step up, progressive cities, and protect our community members. California is leading the charge. SB 54 is going to do that. We're hoping that California actually passes the bill and that it spreads across the country to protect our communities.
Eric Andiola, I want to thank you very much for being with us, a political director for Our Revolution. I'll be speaking tomorrow, Friday, at 1 p.m. at Dolly's Bookstore here in Park City. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
Hey fellow weirdo, this is Rich, host of Radio Lost and Found. Be sure to check out the show in its new time slot. That's every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour mediascape of found records, tapes, found sound, internet insanity, and more. That's Radio Lost and Found every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Hey, weirdo! Come out and play!
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 14 demonstrators were arrested in downtown Portland yesterday at an action calling out the police for violence at last Friday's inauguration rally.
A KBOO volunteer who was present at the Women's March on Washington will weigh in on her experience of the event.
And we'll look at the ongoing fallout of yesterday's executive orders on immigration.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 26th, 2017. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. 12 adults and 2 minors faced a judge this afternoon after disrupting traffic in downtown Portland yesterday in protest of the Portland police. The group who called for the dismissal of Portland Police Chief Mike Marshman stepped into the intersection of Southwest Yamhill and 6th Avenue, blocking cars and buses and a MAX train. Some of the group then boarded a MAX train to the Steel Bridge and walked across, slowing traffic across the river and Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, where traffic was delayed as well. Each of the people arrested received traffic citations for improper position on a highway, Portland police said in a news release. All of the adults face second-degree disorderly conduct charges, and 3 of them face interfering with public transportation charges. Most of the adults were arraigned at 1:45 p.m. this afternoon in Multnomah County Circuit Courtroom. The ACLU of Oregon, as well as other police reform groups, have come out against the actions of the Portland police at last Friday's protest against the inauguration of Donald Trump.
While the Blazer-Laker game at the Moda Center was underway, the Burgerville location near the Convention Center on MLK Boulevard was uncharacteristically empty. The slump in business at Burgerville last night was due to a large union picket taking place right outside the restaurant. The picket was called after shop floor union member Jordan Vanderberg was fired. for his union activity. The reason given by Burgerville Corporate was failure to pay for a 70-cent bagel while he was on break. During peak business hours, Burgerville did almost no business, with picketers giving out free burgers grilled right outside of the restaurant. There were a group of nearly 100 picketers walking the length of the store during all this. Typically on game days, Burgerville workers receive additional staffing for support since they face massive waves of ravenous customers pouring out of the Moda Center before, during, and after the game. KBOO News got in touch with a labor union organizer who provided us with the following clip from a Facebook Live stream.
Over here is the Bagel of Fortune. This auction's over a bagel. Jordan Vandering, a Burgerville worker, was fired over a 70-cent bagel that his manager failed to ring him up for. Very active shop organizer in Vancouver, Washington. We're at MLK. Very popular Burgerville on a Portland Trail Blazers game night. Here we have a burger station. We got some Burgerville workers here cooking up some burgers. Fire truck's not with us. We don't know them.
Those were some of the sounds heard from a picket last night at the Convention Center Burgerville as a union member walked the picket line. For more information on this, go to the Burgerville Workers Union page on Facebook.
Oregon's graduation rate increased by 1% with the class of 2016. This means that 75% of the students earn diplomas within 4 years. The nation's top states managed to graduate 90% of their students. On the positive side, Oregon's graduation rates increased by 3 to 4 points for student groups that have struggled the hardest: students of color, students with disabilities, and low-income students, and those for whom English is a second language. The 1% rise overall means an additional 460 Oregon students earned diplomas. Oregon's graduation rate of 74% for the class of 2015 was the third worst in the nation, trailing the national average by nearly 10 percentage points and beating only Nevada and New Mexico. State schools chief Salam Noor said he was encouraged by the results because of the big gains in groups that had historically high dropout rates.
Employees from more than a dozen U.S. government agencies have established a network of unofficial rogue Twitter feeds in defiance of what they see as attempts by the president to muzzle federal climate change and other science research. Last week, Interior Department staff were told to stop posting on Twitter after an employee retweeted posts about relatively low attendance at Trump's swearing-in. Employees at the EPA and the Departments of Interior, Agriculture, and Health and Human Services have since confirmed seeing notices from the new administration, either instructing them to remove web pages or limit how they communicate with the public, including through social media. The restrictions have reinforced concerns that Trump, who is a climate change skeptic, is out to squelch federally backed research showing that emissions from fossil fuel combustion and other human activities are contributing to global warming. The resistance movement gained steam on Tuesday when a series of climate change-related tweets were posted to the official Twitter account of Badlands National Park out in South Dakota, which is administered under the Interior Department. But soon these were all deleted. Within hours, unofficial resistance or rogue Twitter accounts began sprouting up, emblazoned with the government logos of the agencies where they worked, the list growing to at least 14 such sites by yesterday afternoon. But because the Twitter feeds were set up and posted to anonymously as private accounts, they are beyond the control of the government.
In a recent tweet, President Trump called Chelsea Manning a, quote, ungrateful traitor after Manning shared an op-ed piece she wrote for The Guardian, where she stated that America needs a strong progressive leader. Trump tweeted that Manning called Obama a weak leader, but Manning never actually wrote that in her op-ed. An earlier Fox News report on Manning featured a banner calling Manning an ungrateful traitor, and those are the words that Trump used in his tweet. Just before leaving office, President Obama commuted most of Chelsea Manning's remaining prison sentence from 2045 to this coming May. Manning had been convicted in 2013 for leaking more than 700,000 confidential documents to WikiLeaks, while working as an intelligence analyst in Iraq.
U.S. President Donald Trump is going to publish a weekly list of crimes committed by immigrants and deport immigrants from sanctuary cities. President Trump plans to publicize criminal actions committed by aliens and to crack down on sanctuary cities that protect migrants from being deported. It does not specify that only crimes committed by illegal immigrants should be included on the list. This raises the question of those offenses committed by immigrants who are in the U.S. legally. The order claimed that the measures were needed to ensure the safety and territorial integrity of the United States. It also said that illegal immigrants present a significant threat to national security and public safety. In response to Mr. Trump's threat on sanctuaries, the Democratic mayors of a number of large U.S. cities, including New York, Chicago, and Seattle, said they would refuse to cooperate with federal authorities attempting to deport immigrants. The Republican president responded by saying that he would starve such cities of federal funding, and he has now signed into law via a second executive order already signed on the same day and titled Enhancing Public Safety in the Interior of the United States.
In cities across the country, from New Haven, Connecticut, to Chicago, to Portland, local governments are responding to Donald Trump's threat yesterday to pull federal funding from so-called sanctuary cities. A sanctuary city is one that offers relatively safe haven to undocumented immigrants by refusing to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement. Trump signed an executive order on Wednesday making his threat official. In Los Angeles, the city council created the Ad Hoc Committee on Immigrant Affairs after the election, where law enforcement, social justice advocates, and educators discuss their response to the new administration's immigration policies. Lena Nozizwe of Free Speech Radio News was at the first meeting last night and has this report.
On the same day that President Donald Trump signed executive orders to immediately begin construction on a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, increase the number of immigration agents to facilitate more deportations, and punish so-called sanctuary cities, Los Angeles lawmakers were building their own wall to thwart Trump's sweeping directives regarding the city's undocumented residents.
This is what I would call institutional resistance.
City Councilman Gil Cedillo opened the first meeting of the newly formed Ad Hoc Committee on Immigrant Affairs by recalling a conversation he had with a prominent L.A. businessman shortly after the presidential elections.
And he said, look, Councilmember, we are either resistors or collaborators. He said, we are either resistors or collaborators. And I said, oh, okay. And he said, I want to say this to you because my grandparents told us that when our family was in Nazi Germany, there were those who believed that they could work with the Nazis. And that didn't work out for us. And so we have a decision and a choice to make, to resist or to collaborate.
Resistance was the common theme in the standing room only LA City Council chambers Wednesday night. The Migration Policy Institute estimates that of the 11 million undocumented residents thought to be living in the U.S., about 1 million call Los Angeles home. They have the ear of a city council that includes member David Ru, an immigrant from South Korea.
I am quite frankly stunned and overwhelmed with emotion. My heart especially breaks for the millions of people, especially the children, who are going to go to bed afraid tonight because they feel uncertain about their futures.
During the presidential campaign, Trump vowed to build a massive deportation force to expel millions of undocumented immigrants, quote, humanely, end quote. The two executive orders issued Wednesday lay the groundwork for the mass detention and expulsion of so-called removable aliens and the expansion of immigration detention facilities along the border. Since the election, Cal State Fullerton professor Christine Valenciana has been hearing from fearful students.
I feel the tenseness, I feel the hysteria The kids are terrified. I got an email from a student the other day. What am I supposed to do? I know you're interested in these kinds of things.
But the White House has indicated undocumented immigrants convicted or suspected of criminal offenses will be prioritized for prompt removal. Since the election, the LAPD leadership has made it clear that it does not believe the department is responsible for detaining immigrants, no matter what their legal status. In fact, the city's police officers are specifically prohibited from initiating contact based on suspected immigration status under a 1979 provision known as Special Order 40. Deputy Police Chief Robert Arcos explains why it's important to keep federal immigration law enforcement separate from the duties of local policing.
We must rely on the cooperation and partnership of all the diverse communities in Los Angeles. Victims of crime, especially those who can be exploited because of their status and are vulnerable to harm, must not fear calling the police for help. Witnesses to crime, similarly, must not fear calling the police or testifying against an accused in criminal courts if we are to keep our communities safe.
The executive actions Wednesday directly target so-called sanctuary cities by seeking to cut off billions of dollars in federal funding for some 400 jurisdictions. Local governments prohibit spending their resources on immigration law enforcement. Many of them are found in states that did not vote for Trump. A defiant L.A. City Council working with a county has already put aside $10 million to assist anyone who needs legal help to fight deportation. With just 1 week into the opening salvos of what is shaping up to be a huge battle between the federal government and local municipalities, L.A. is but one of hundreds of jurisdictions already resisting across the country, hoping to prove the adage, you can't fight City Hall. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, today estimated the cost of a wall along the Mexican border at least $12 to $15 billion. GOP leaders refused to commit to paying for the wall with spending cuts elsewhere in the budget. On Wednesday, President Trump promised that immediate construction would begin on the project, and he vowed that Mexico would pay the U.S. back for it. However, that same day, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto declared that Mexico would not foot the bill under any circumstances. President Trump then twittered that the meeting between him and Peña Nieto, scheduled for next week, should be canceled if Mexico refuses to pay. This morning, Mexico announced that next week's meeting has already been canceled.
Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto announced today that he is canceling his trip to the U.S. to meet with Donald Trump next Tuesday. Trump signed an executive order calling for the construction of a border wall yesterday, alongside an order threatening sanctuary cities in the U.S. In a pair of petulant tweets this morning, Trump told Peña Nieto to cancel next week's trip if Mexico still refused to pay for the 2,000-mile barrier. Peña Nieto canceled the trip within hours with widespread backing from Mexicans on social media. The Mexican president also reiterated his country's refusal to pay for the wall. Trump has repeatedly insisted during his campaign and now during his presidency that Mexico will pay for it, threatening various trade penalties. The new U.S. protectionist strategy is already hitting the Mexican economy and currency hard. Clayton Kahn with Free Speech Radio News has this report from the Mexican capital.
Here in Mexico City's neighborhood markets, vendors and consumers are feeling the stress of a recent 20% hike in gasoline prices and the prolonged plunge of the peso against the dollar. Food prices have jumped since the start of the year, and inflation is now at nearly 5%. For Marta Vasquez, a small restaurant owner and dairy vendor, the economic stagnation has forced her to keep her eatery closed and to limit what she sells in her market stall.
There are ingredients that are used which are imported, and obviously that's why the prices have gone up. Although the people look for these things, you can also present them with other options and they can choose. So this is how I try to counteract the effects of the rise of the dollar and the devaluation of the peso.
The anxiety is particularly acute for Mexico's low and minimum wage earners. Making roughly $4 a day, the devalued peso and price hikes are forcing these consumers, such as Virginia Montoya, to make very tough decisions.
You either go to the doctor or buy meat. You either buy medicine or you buy milk or eggs. Basically, it isn't enough. You can't make enough.
The peso has been on a downward slide for the last 3 years, but dropped sharply the day after the U.S. presidential election and is yet to recover. U.S. President Donald Trump's threats to punitively tax manufacturing exports from Mexico, restrict remittances, remove the U.S. from the North American Free Trade Agreement, and Wednesday's executive order to further fortify the U.S.-Mexican border has caused further volatility. In response to the U.S.'s new aggressive protectionist economic model, Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto argued in a speech on foreign policy the need for his country to continue to attract private investment and promote free trade.
Mexico puede.
Mexico can and must increase the diversification of its economic and political relations. In that sense, the government of the Republic should have a balanced, pragmatic, and timely agenda to expand the destination of exports and sources of investment.
However, some critics reject Peña Nieto's strategy to continue the country's two-decades-old neoliberal economic model. Arturo Huerta, professor of economics at Mexico's National Autonomous University and research fellow at the Levy Economics Institute in the United States, argues that Mexico must turn towards greater economic independence rather than diversify its dependence.
There is no longer a position of cooperation between the countries, but the individual position of trying to get the most out of international trade with economic policies in favor of what is national. Mexico is still waiting for foreign investment to grow because Mexico lost control of its currency, central authority, and that leads to having no economic policy, no monetary policy, no fiscal policy, no crediting policy in favor of growth. We depend on attracting foreign capital, and from there, what comes next? Attracting capital in a context where capital will no longer come because it only came because Mexico produces for the United States, exports to the United States, and at the moment the United States is going to put in place barriers. And logically, what will no longer be attractive is the Mexican economy.
Yet back in the market in Mexico City, dairy vendor Marta Vasquez says a silver lining of the economic crisis has been the reinforced ties between residents and small market vendors.
Here in the market, what has been going on is that people are helping us by not buying in Walmart or the Aurrera chain stores. They are coming to us and we are basically supporting each other economically.
Mexico sent a delegation of top officials to the White House this week to jumpstart talks ahead of a previously scheduled meeting between Presidents Peña Nieto and Trump. But when Trump signed the executive orders on immigration and the wall the same day as the delegation arrived, it created a major controversy within Mexico. On Thursday, Peña Nieto officially canceled his trip to the United States. Analysts fear further economic volatility is to come for Mexico and that it is already heading towards a deeper diplomatic crisis. Clayton Kahn, FSRN. Mexico City.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. And at 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective, followed by Guess Who's Coming to Radio with Jamila Bourdon. Tomorrow's weather will be partially cloudy with dense fog in the morning, a high of about 49, a low of about 33, kind of normal. Today, in history, January 26th was apparently the International Get Rid of the British Day. In 1885, troops who were loyal to the Mahdi captured Khartoum in the Sudan, killing the entire British garrison. In 1930, the Indian National Congress declared January 26th to be Independence Day and initiated the vast campaign that would eventually help lead to the subcontinent's freedom from Britain. 20 years later, on this day in 1950, the Indian Constitution went into effect officially, establishing India as an independent republic. And in 1952, as part of Black Saturday, Egyptian rioters targeted specifically British and upper-class Egyptian businesses in central Cairo. Today's quote comes from George Orwell, who said, "The nationalist not only does not disapprove of atrocities committed by his own side, but he has a remarkable capacity for not even hearing about them.
It's 5:23. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Actor Jack Nicholson says he finally understood the meaning of the word irony when his mother called him a son of a bitch. So let us consider Donnie Trump, who campaigned as the populist champion of the working class, promising that by gollies he was going to take on Wall Street and the corporate elites. But the bitter irony for the working class is that they now see what the SOB meant. He's literally taking on the moneyed powers by taking them on board his administration. For example, he's brought in Wall Street billionaires to fill the three top economic policy positions in his cabinet. Then there's Betsy DeVos, the billionaire heiress to the scandal-plagued Amway fortune. Her life's work has been trying to defund and privatize the public schools that working-class people count on and to eliminate the working-class jobs of teachers and support staff. Her new job with Trump? Secretary of Education, where she'll now use our public money to try killing off our public education system. And here comes Myron Ebell, a honcho of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a corporate front group funded by fossil fuel profiteers like Exxon and the Koch brothers, where he pushed relentlessly to gut the Environmental Protection Agency. Where's he now? Heading Trump's EPA transition team. Also, more than half of the Donald's Department of Defense transition team have been executives or lobbyists for such military contractors as Boeing. Overall, according to watchdog group Public Citizen, three-fourths of Trump's transition teams, which are organizing, staffing, and shaping our new government, come from corporate world. Not a single working-class populist has been allowed a seat at his power table. This is Jim Hightower saying, as America's working stiffs know, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Trump is no populist. He's a full-tilt corporatist.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A KABU reporter recently attended the Women's March in Washington, D.C. She shares with us her observations on the reality of peaceful protest and her ruminations on the parallels between recent events and lessons that history has already taught us. Here is KABU's Miriam Widman with her story.
It's hard to digest the emotions. They range from anger to joy to fear, stemming from a few recent days in Washington, D.C. I got there a week ago, in time for the inauguration protest last Friday. Hard to believe that the nation's narcissist in chief has been in power for a week. I got nervous. There weren't that many protesters, and it had already turned violent. Store windows at Starbucks and Bank of America had been smashed in downtown D.C. But as soon as I tried to get on the subway the next day for the Women's March, that all disappeared. Waves and waves of pink hats, overcrowded subways, people singing and chanting, and folks just being respectful. Even the cops were nice. Officer Langer, who was assigned to where I ended up, 12th and Independence Avenues, was rallying up the crowd and having a good time along with the protesters. Imagine a demonstration of over 500,000 people and no one was arrested. What a contrast in tone and character to the hate-filled events the current president launched at his campaign rallies and still presides over. But then the march was over, and it was time to do some sightseeing in the nation's capital, and I picked two museums that proved to be creepy choices. First, the Holocaust Museum, complete with its extensive exhibit of Hitler's rise to power, including information about Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister. Some of his more well-known quotes include, "If you tell a lie long enough, it becomes the truth," or "The truth is the greatest enemy of the state," or perhaps one of his most famous or infamous, "It would not be impossible to prove, with sufficient repetition and a psychological understanding of the people concerned, that a square is in fact a circle." Remember, this is the Holocaust Museum, and this happened some 80 years ago, and I wish it weren't true, but there are so many corollaries between then and now. Trump wrongly insisting that his inaugural crowd was the highest ever, not only in the United States, but worldwide. Trump repeating the lie that millions of illegal immigrants voted for Hillary Clinton, and that's why he lost the popular vote. It would come as no surprise to me if Trump claimed that a square is actually a circle. Following my visit to the Holocaust Museum, I went over to the new African American Museum. I didn't have a ticket, but I lucked out when a guard gave me one. It is a fabulous exhibit, but also a very sad one, and it is hard to be a white person inside this museum. In fact, it's embarrassing to be a white person inside this museum. I dwelled for a long time at the many exhibits covering the civil rights era, the integration of Southern schools, Brown versus Board of Education, which declared that separate is not equal, the marches on Washington, and of course, the brutal violence of police and citizen oppression in the Jim Crow South. There's a whole section on lynchings and another one devoted to Emmett Till, a 14-year-old boy who was brutally murdered in Mississippi in 1955 after being accused of flirting with a white woman. The museum then takes you through the election of America's first African-American president, and there is at least some sense that some progress has been made, along with a creepy feeling that the battles fought 50 years ago may now have to be revisited. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Miriam Widman.
America, land of the free, is also the world's leading jailer. With just 5% of the world's population, we now hold 25% of its inmates, according to the ACLU. By the close of 2010, America had more than 2.2 million people locked up at a cost of $80 billion. In a recent study, the nonprofit Prison Policy Institute estimated the annual cost of mass incarceration at $182 billion, more than twice the 2010 figure. The new study takes a more holistic view and includes tens of billions of dollars in policing and court expenses that have nothing to do with the criminal law enforcement. The largest cost component was $80.7 billion for public corrections agencies, including prisons, jails, parole, and probation systems. Cost of health care alone was estimated at $12.3 billion. Some of the lesser known but still big players are major forces. For example, bail bond companies collect $1.4 billion in non-refundable fees from defendants and their families. Specialized phone companies with monopoly contracts and charge families up to $24.95 for a 15-minute phone call. With crime at a near record low and increasing privatization in the justice system, the study follows the money in order to get a more expansive view of how the criminal justice system really works.
And now we hear the latest news in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Any president's got to go, hey, hey.
Fast food workers and their supporters will rally in protest in 30 U.S. cities Thursday, protesting the nomination of Andy Puzder as labor secretary. The Fight for 15 workers movement says under Puzder's tenure as CEO, Carl's Jr. and Hardee's have been hit with more federal employment discrimination lawsuits than any other major U.S. hamburger chain. Fight for 15 says it's releasing a major announcement about Puzder's fast food company, CKE, as the protests unfold. Keeping the minimum wage low is so important to Puzder, he spent $10,000 of his own money to fight a ballot initiative in Nevada that would have raised the minimum wage at the time from $5.15 an hour to $6.15. The Thursday protests accuse Puzder of stealing worker wages. Puzder makes more in a day than the average fast food worker makes all year. The Trump resistance is mobilizing in Bakersfield, California, Friday at the congressional office of Republican Representative Kevin McCarthy, the House Majority Leader. Senior citizens, nurses, and Kern County residents will tell McCarthy to protect, improve, and expand Medicare, not cut it. Hundreds of people are expected at Representative McCarthy's Bakersfield, California office to speak up for Medicare. Dish Network is being ordered to reinstate 18 union-represented workers and to rescind unilateral changes in terms and conditions of employment at two sites in Texas. The National Labor Relations Board says Dish Network prematurely declared an impasse in collective bargaining to impose its conditions on the workers. The NLRB administrative law judge decision requires Dish Network to make the workers whole for any losses they incurred during the changes imposed on them by the company. That includes back pay. Dish Network must also return to the bargaining table with the Communications Workers of America. Earlier this month, U.S. District Judge Reed O'Connor granted a preliminary injunction against Dish Network, ordering the company to restore what the judge called drastic wage cuts at the two Dish Network facilities in Farmers Branch and North Richland Hills, Texas. Brought to you in part by the Alliance for American Manufacturing, working to build coalitions between business, labor, legislators, and activists. Information about our mission to strengthen American manufacturing and rebuild the middle class through smart public policy is available online at AmericanManufacturing.org. WIN is brought to you in part by the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest labor union representing transit and allied workers in the U.S. and Canada. Online at ATU.org.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Russia's parliament gave overwhelming support to a draft law that would ease some penalties for domestic violence, alarming women's rights campaigners who fear it will encourage abuse. The amendment treats a first conviction for domestic battery as an administrative offense, carrying a penalty of $500 or 15 days in jail. If Russian President Vladimir Putin signs the measure into law, only injuries like concussions or broken bones or repeated offenses committed in a family setting would lead to criminal charges. Defenders of the measure say it will protect parents' rights to discipline their children and generally reduce the state's role in domestic violence. Svetlana Ivazova and other experts say that Russia has serious problem with domestic violence. Citing data provided by Russia's Interior Ministry, Ivazova told Putin in 2015 that, quote, 40% of all grave violent crimes are committed in families, end quote. In 2013, she said more than 9,000 women died in criminal assaults and more than 11,000 were badly injured. In 2014, more than 25% of all murders in Russia were committed within families.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imc.org, for Thursday, January 26, 2017. Israel troops kill a Palestinian man in the West Bank and abduct civilians during dawn invasions. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers killed on Wednesday evening a young Palestinian man at a bus station close to the illegal colony east of the central West Bank city of Ramallah after he reportedly tried to ram soldiers with his car. The army is claiming that the Palestinian, Hussein Salem Abu Ghosh, 24, drove his car off-road and crashed into the bus station near Adam settlement where many soldiers and settlers were waiting, and allegedly that he carried a knife but did not leave the car. The army added that the incident did not lead to any casualties among the soldiers or the settlers. Abu Ghosh from Kalandia refugee camp was shot multiple times and bled to death after the soldiers prevented Palestinian medics from approaching him. The army placed his corpse in a black bag and loaded it in their jeep before driving to Jerusalem. The soldiers installed many roadblocks and searched dozens of cars, especially in Hizma, Jabaa, Atarot, and roads leading to Kalandia refugee camp north of occupied Jerusalem. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers abducted on Thursday at dawn at least 9 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank. The army is claiming that the soldiers also located a women manufacturing workshop in Hebron. The Israeli army spokesperson said that the soldiers initiated an excessive campaign in the southern West Bank district of Hebron and located a workshop containing 8 lathe machines that were reportedly used for manufacturing weapons. He added that the invasion was part of the so-called ongoing battle against guns and weapons manufacturing workshops. The soldiers conducted excessive searches of homes in different parts of the occupied West Bank and abducted 9 Palestinians from their homes. The abductions were largely carried out in the Jenin refugee camp in the northern West Bank city of Jenin, in addition to Bidya town and Askar refugee camp in Nablus district, Dehesha refugee camp in Bethlehem, in addition to Yatta and Idna in Hebron. Initial reports indicate that Israeli soldier was seriously injured in Jenin refugee camp after Palestinian protesters hurled firebombs and pipe bombs at invading military vehicles. In other news, the Egyptian government announced on Thursday that it will open the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt for 3 days both ways starting on Saturday. According to the Palestinian embassy in Cairo, the border crossing will be open for stranded travelers on both sides of the borders, students, patients, and aid supplies. Since Israel placed the Gaza Strip under siege back in 2006, the Rafah crossing became the only way for Palestinians to travel in or out of the coastal enclave. Egyptian authorities keep the crossing closed for most days of the year, forcing the 2 million residents of Gaza to depend on goods and supplies coming from tunnels under the borders with Egypt. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, January 26, 2017, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Barnoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tom Flynn, Jack Petz, Kanan Schlesinger, Grace Ann Smith, and Miriam Widman. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to our friends at Free Speech Radio News at fsrn.org. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Charity Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Robert Barncourt. Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday, the 27th of January on KBOO. At 7, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn will welcome your calls on their show, Positively Revolting. At 9, it's Pacific Underground with interviews from Douglas Choi, the founder of the Portland Underground Grad School, known as PUGS, and Portland rock band The Slants will discuss their recent Supreme Court case. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. At 11 a.m. tomorrow, One Land, Many Voices explores the issues affecting the Palestinian-Israeli conflict from a human rights perspective. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one by simply going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO News in depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
KBOO reporter and web coordinator Jenka Soderberg was at the downtown protest last Friday. It was a complicated event with many different groups showing their displeasure with the inauguration of Donald Trump in different ways. Jenka was in Pioneer Square and spoke with organizers, attendees, and recorded some of the speakers and musicians.
As being at PSU, to rely on my connection, student groups with organizations on campus, kind of like standing all together, demanding more from the administration, I think that gave me, you know, more safety and power too, and the continuing, the organizing was almost a survival strategy, really. So.
Well, and you had success.
I did have success. Yes. I mean,
not just you, but the students at PSU.
I feel like it was very challenging times, and we put forward a lot of really important solidarity issues. And I'm really proud how we all together, just organizing together, we actually delivered. We actually had a plan. We worked for it. We fought and we won. So.
Well, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dana Yazzie, former student body president at Portland State University. And so we are live now at the Pioneer Square, where flag burning, I think, extravaganza is completed. Now there's more of a rally happening.
We must stand and protect her, because without her, we're nothing at all. Water is life. This air is the truth. We are the voice of the water. We are the voice of the water. We are the voice of the water. We are the Thank you, Alan.
Next up, Francisco Lopez is going to speak to all of us. I don't know if any of you have ever heard Francisco speak before, but he always speaks from the heart, and it's beautiful. Francisco is part of Voz Hispana Cambio Comunitario, which means Hispanic Voice for Community Change. Francisco is an immigrant from El Salvador, a proud dad of two boys, and the political director of Voz. Ladies and gentlemen, open up your ears, open up your hearts. Let's listen to Francisco.
Are we ready to march? Are we ready to resist? I cannot hear you. Are you ready to resist? Today, once again, Donald Trump showed what kind of America he wants. He was today not speaking to the United States of America. He was speaking to white America. I want to tell this man, we are going to...